My name is Melissa Curvin. I'm a law graduate licensed under Illinois Supreme Court Rule 711. I represent the appellant, Mr. Henry Savage. Mr. Savage was convicted of possession with intent to distribute crack cocaine, although there was insufficient evidence at trial to support the jury's finding that it was, in fact, crack. Mr. Savage raised several arguments on appeal, and I would like to begin with the enhancement that the judge imposed for obstruction of justice. The judge imposed a two-level enhancement on Mr. Savage's sentence based on the finding that he obstructed justice. The Supreme Court's opinion in Dunnigan represents the requirements that a trial judge must have before imposing the enhancement for obstruction of justice. It is not enough simply to say that the trial court believes that the defendant committed perjury. The trial court must make findings that encompass all of the factual predicates of perjury, and that was not present in this case. An adequacy of these conclusions is reviewed de novo. Your Honors, the court did not identify any particular false statements that Mr. Savage made at trial and did not find that any particular false statements amounted to obstruction. The court did not find that all of the factual predicates of perjury were present. Specifically, the court never addressed the elements that the perjury must be willful and material to the case. And this court in Seward found that where the court did not identify particular false statements and did not indicate that any particular false statements were material, that that was not sufficient to satisfy the requirements of Dunnigan.
The judge came back to that issue sort of later on in the sentencing proceeding. I mean, he says earlier on that he's going to award or tack on the points for obstruction of justice without identifying what statements he's referring to, if that's having been perjurious. But he does come back to it later on and identify what he's talking about. It's your position that's still insufficient?
It is still insufficient. Your Honor, there are several things that could be addressed as particular factual statements that the judge considered. The first is within the pre-sentence investigation report. The pre-sentence investigation report recommended enhancement for obstruction of justice, but that was based solely on the fact that Mr. Savage was convicted at trial, and that's not sufficient. Furthermore, the government addressed statements that the government believed amounted to perjury, but that's not sufficient either because the trial judge is required to make an independent finding as to specific statements that meet the factual predicates of perjury. And the specific statements that the trial court did address related to statements that Mr. Savage made that were contradicted by his expert, Dr. Rubin. Specifically, Mr. Savage stated that he had told Dr. Rubin about specific statements that Martin Valadez made to him, and Dr. Rubin denied that Mr. Savage had made those statements. The trial court never found that those statements by Mr. Savage were willful or material, and it's entirely possible that they were not. Those statements could have been made simply out of confusion or mistake. It's possible that Mr. Savage forgot exactly what he told Dr. Rubin when he met with Dr. Rubin about the specific statements that Martin Valadez made to him. And the trial court did not even indicate that it recognized that it was required to find that those statements were willful or malicious.
But
material, I'm sorry.
For obstruction of justice enhancement on the basis of testimony, you actually have to find all the elements of perjury, right? You're not being prosecuted for perjury. He's getting a sentence bonus. Do you have all? I mean, clearly it has to be deliberately false, but is there anything beyond that?
Yes, Your Honor. In Dunnigan, the Supreme Court specifically stated that the trial court's independent findings must encompass all of the factual predicates of perjury. And the Supreme Court said that it was preferable if the judge went through all of the elements individually and specifically explained why those elements were met. That's not required, but it is required that the finding encompass all of those factual predicates of perjury. And this finding did not. The trial court merely said that he believed certain statements were false. The trial court did not say anything that indicates that the judge even understood that he was required to find that those statements were willful or material rather than simply a mistake or made out of confusion. If I may, I would like to move on to the evidentiary issue. Your Honors.
Is it your position you could tell a lie even if then the court would have to find that there was a material lie?
Yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court standard in Dunnigan.
So the question whether he forgot or didn't remember or was confused has nothing to do with the issue you're raising.
There are multiple factual predicates of perjury. One is that the mistake was material, that the statement was material, and another is that the statement was willful.
Some fact and issue.
Yes, that it was material to a fact and issue.
Some fact and issue.
Yes, and also that it was willfully false. The trial court must make a factual finding that encompasses both of those predicates. Your Honor, the trial court did not permit Mr. Savage to enter into evidence several letters that were written to him by Martin Valadez, and this decision was an abuse of discretion. At trial, Mr. Savage did not contest that he purchased cocaine on July 29th of 2003. He argued that the cocaine that he purchased was not crack, but the only issue presented to the jury on the question of guilt or innocence was whether Mr. Valadez coerced him into purchasing the crack on that day, the cocaine on that day. And the letters that Mr. Valadez wrote to Mr. Savage would have increased the credibility of Mr. Savage's coercion defense with the jury, and therefore they should have been admitted. The jury was not given any physical evidence that Mr. Valadez ever threatened Mr. Savage. And in closing argument, the prosecutor told the jury that Mr. Savage was never threatened.
That's not a bad argument, but I don't understand how you could possibly have a coercion defense in a case like this, because after being threatened by Valadez, there was nothing to prevent Savage from going to the police. It seems to me for a coercion defense, there has to be a situation in which you cannot invoke a public protection.
Yes, Your Honor, but the coercion defense was submitted to the jury. The jury was.
Shouldn't have been. I don't think there was any basis for submitting a coercion defense.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, Mr. Savage's argument here was that he did not believe that he could go to the police.
Why not?
Because he believed that Mr. Valadez was going to hurt him, and based on the specific threats that Mr. Valadez had stated, I will shoot you like I shot Eddie Hurt.
He went to the police and they arrested Valadez. How could Valadez hurt him?
Mr. Valadez is the leader of the Latin Kings, which is a street gang in Chicago, and probably even from jail could have arranged Mr. Savage's death. Mr. Valadez did not personally kill Eddie Hurt. He simply arranged to have him killed, and Mr. Savage was justified in believing that Mr. Valadez could have done the same thing to him. Your Honors, the letters in question would have increased the credibility of Mr. Savage's coercion defense with the jury. As I said, the jury was not given any physical evidence that Mr. Savage was in fact threatened, and in its closing argument, the prosecutor argued that he was not threatened. And at this point, all that the jury had to look at was Mr. Savage's word against the prosecutor's word, and Mr. Savage had no hope of winning that argument. But if he had been allowed to enter these letters into evidence, he would have had a chance with the jury, and therefore it was an abuse of discretion and reversible error not to allow these letters into evidence. Mr. Savage's coercion defense would have been made credible by the fact that the jury had physical evidence that Mr. Valadez did in fact threaten Mr. Savage. I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Curvin. Mr. Blakey?
May it please the court, counsel. Jack Blakey on behalf of the United States, the appellee. Let me address first, I believe, counsel's argument regarding the obstruction enhancement. First, the trial court did not base its finding solely on the jury's verdict. That's what the defendant suggests in his brief, and it's clear from the record that the court said you can't tell what the jury determined based on their finding. So the judge made an independent finding. Secondly, the defendant obstructed justice, and that's exactly what the court found. He found that the defendant was untruthful in his testimony, and in that finding he incorporated not only the other testimony at trial, but the evidence in the pre-sentence investigation. The defendant lied regarding matters that were material. The court said, I observed him during this part of the testimony. His answers were clear, his responses lucid. But frankly, observing him, considering his testimony as it was presented on the witness stand, and considering his testimony against the other evidence here in the pre-sentence investigation report, it's clear that Mr. Savage did not testify truthfully. Obviously, we have the truthful finding there. He cannot avoid, it seems to me, an obstruction of two levels upward. The judge imposes the enhancement, and then he says, because he has obstructed or attempted to obstruct justice. He's making a finding of willfulness.
Does he say what portion was of the lies were material to the issue in fact?
Your Honor, during sentencing, the particular statements that were at issue were identified by the United States government, the United States,
I
and the person.
I asked whether the judge had identified what he thought was material that was a, constituted a lie about something material.
Your Honor, he did not come out and say X is material
so
because materiality.
He didn't.
Your Honor, our position is that his finding encompasses materiality because the materiality of the statements and the identity of the statements was never challenged by anyone at sentencing. The government's...
My question was relatively simple. I said, did the judge identify what he thought was a lie about a material fact?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe in his findings he identified statements, and he also said...
Like where? Read it to me.
Well, he said the government's position is well taken. He said, based on the evidence in the pre-sentence investigation report, the judge incorporates...
Did he say what statement?
He incorporates in his finding exactly what...
Did he say what statement in the pre-sentence report? The pre-sentence report can't be the perjury because he didn't can do that. That's somebody else prepared the pre-sentence report. Is his statement to the probation officer constitute the perjury he's talking about? Or is
no,
it
Your
Honor. Testament?
I simply am suggesting that when the judge made his ruling, he was incorporating, and his statements need to be taken in context. The fact that everyone in the room was talking about the same statements, and no one was challenging that those statements
were... What were those statements?
The statements were the defendant lied about whether or not...
No, that's not a statement. What did he say that's a lie?
He said on the stand...
Characterizing a statement as a lie is not a statement. I want to know, what did he say that the court found was a lie?
Oh, what the defendant said, Your Honor. I apologize. The defendant said on the stand that the co-defendant threatened me, and that's why I committed that particular offense.
And that's
an
what
immediate
he found
threat.
Was the lie.
He found that was not true. He also said...
Where did he say that he found that was not true?
He said that his testimony on the witness stand, considering his testimony and the evidence in the pre-sentence report and the fact that he's saying the government's points are well taken, where we identify page and number of exactly which statements that we're relying upon.
So we don't know what statement he was talking about.
Well, there was only several statements that were at issue.
Several.
At the
I don't know which one he said was a lie. Did everything he said was a lie?
He's saying, Your Honor, that the position of the government regarding particular statements and that those identified in the pre-sentence investigation report were the ones at issue before him.
He said that.
It's clear from the context of the record,
he said
Your Honor.
That. Or you read it into it.
Your Honor, I think what the Supreme Court in the Rita case...
No.
Your Honor,
you're still talking to me. You're not talking to the Supreme Court. No, did he say that?
Your Honor, I think you have to take the judge's findings in context. He did not say element X, element Y.
I know what you think. You see, you got to give me this. I have to think, and you think. We don't know where our thinking now becomes important. What I want to know is what the judge said that would specifically nail something that the defendant said that was perjury. That is, to discuss what material piece he was talking about.
It had to do with whether or not the defendant knew the material was crack and whether or not...
That's good. Did he say that he found it? He lied about that?
I believe it's clear from the context of the record, yes, Your Honor.
So the answer is no, he didn't, but you have to read it into the record for reading the context of it.
Yes, by taking the court's comments
read
in context,
everything. If
yes,
I read
it's clear.
Everything the court said, I know exactly what you lied about.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If I read everything the court said, I will know exactly what it is the defendant lied about.
I believe so, Your Honor. If you look at the entire record, if you look at his comments in relation to what was actually presented to the court.
Well, I think what you were saying was he explicitly said he agreed with the government, which had identified statements that were lies.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So if you read the statements,
you have to read
both of them. Exactly what the judge...
Yes, Your Honor.
You have to read what the judge said and what you said. Were you the trial judge, the trial lawyer, by the way?
I was one of the trial lawyers, Your Honor.
Did you make the statement to the court in sentencing?
No, Mr. Bars did. It was identified orally, And in the government's version, which was attached to the pre-sentence investigation, and in a lengthy sentencing memorandum, which broke out the statements and made citations to the record, none of those statements was challenged by any of the individuals present before the judge at sentencing.
The problem is that the statements that Mr. Barr's identified as lies are different from the ones that you're identifying here. So I'm not tracking with this argument. Mr. Barr said the statements that were lies were when the defendant testified that he told his doctor about the threat, and the doctor said, no, he didn't.
Yes, sir.
And when he testified that he told the agent about the threat, and the agent said, no, he didn't.
Yes, whether or not the defendant told his doctor about these threats was relevant to whether or not, immaterial, to whether or not co-defendant actually threatened him.
Right, but my point is that those are different lies than you're pointing out right now. So what are we to make of that? I mean, your argument seems to be that the court adopted, by implication, not necessarily explicitly, the government's argument. I mean, it seems to me that's what you're arguing,
yes,
right?
Yes, Your
Honor. And the argument that the government made for the application of the enhancement is the one that I just stated, and I think the transcript bears that out because I have it right in front of me.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's different from what you're saying now. Now you're saying he lied about whether the threat was ever made, and he lied about the substance in question.
He lied whether or not he had communicated that threat to his doctor. If I misspoke, I apologize. He lied about whether or not he knew it was crack cocaine, which was identified by Mr. Barrs in the written submission to the court and in the pre-sentence investigation.
But not in the argument.
Oh, sorry. Let me ask you a different question. I don't understand the exclusion of Valdez's threats after the post-crime threats.
Your Honor, it was excluded on several bases by the trial court. One, the coercion defense could not be substantiated by threats happening after the conduct,
See,
obviously.
What I don't understand. This is actually related to the Parr case that we heard shortly before. That is, we're trying to assess the gravity of a threat in both cases, trying to address the gravity of the threat, and anything that Valdez says before, after, during, helps a jury to determine whether this is a person who's serious. His character is quite relevant to whether Savage could reasonably believe that Valdez would be able to do something to him. Don't you think?
If the court believes that a propensity theory regarding that evidence would substantiate the defendant's trial testimony, it might have some probative value.
Look, we've differentiated between this character evidence when it's used against the defendant and when it's used against someone else. So blackening Mr. Valdez's character is not as serious a problem as it would be with Savage, because Valdez isn't the defendant. So the question is, as I say, in evaluating Savage's state of mind, is he really terrified of Valdez? Anything that shows how dangerous Valdez is would be relevant to Savage's understanding.
Provided it's not cumulative or confusing, which the judge found in both.
Why would it be confusing?
It's confusing because the threats related not so much to the defendant's violent nature, but to his desire to have the defendant not testify at the co-defendant's trial, which had nothing to do with the case before the jury. The jury was to decide whether or not Savage was coerced prior to the offense, not whether or not he was intimidated from testifying against his co-defendant. When you can consider that,
of course,
in conjunction
the purpose of
the
offer was to show that he was a man of violence and that he could follow through on a threat, and which would indicate he could threaten up front as well.
But that wasn't challenged by the government. It wasn't even at issue at trial. In fact, the government brought out in its testimony of the agent the fact that the co-defendant was a violent person, that he was the leader of a gang,
right,
and also the defendant.
He said he already agreed that he could have coerced him.
Well, he agreed that he was a violent person, Your Honor, but he did not coerce this defendant prior to the offense because at that point in time, they were partners, they were roommates, they were not at odds. Later on, when they became at odds and both became defendants in a federal case, obviously his position toward
the... Do you accept that you can have a coercion defense where there's no imminent threat?
No, Your Honor. You need to have an imminent threat in order to meet a coercion defense.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Blakey. And Ms. Kervan, how much time does she have? 2 minutes?
Your Honors, the prosecutor points to the judge's statement in the sentencing proceeding that Mr. Savage testified that his testimony was not truthful. That's simply a blanket statement that's not sufficient. And the prosecutor also points to the judge's specific statement because he obstructed justice. The prosecutor claimed in his argument that the statement, because he obstructed justice, encompasses all the factual findings, predicates of perjury, and that that's sufficient. And this court has specifically rejected that. And simply saying that the defendant testified untruthfully is not enough under either this court standard or the Supreme Court standard in Dunnigan. The judge must make specific findings that the defendant made statements that were willful and materially false. And there were no statements by the trial judge that allow us to come to that conclusion. The government may believe that the statement...
If the prosecutor said in its enunciation to the judge, Your Honor, this man lied in a stand about something material, and he lied about this specific thing, and the judge said, I accept that, I think you're right. Is that sufficient?
Well, Your Honor, that's not what the judge said in this case.
I know, but is that sufficient?
No, I don't believe so, because
he has to reiterate exactly what it was the prosecutor said.
Well, the judge must make independent findings and simply...
He can agree with someone else.
The specific finding is that I find that what you just said was true.
I think that if the judge said, I think everything that you just said is true, and therefore I'm imposing an obstruction enhancement, that would be sufficient. But that's not the case that we have here. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. As long as the trial judge clearly adopted agreement with the fact that those particular statements were willfully and materially false. But in this case, he did not. He listened to what the prosecutor had to say, and then he made his own statements about what he believed, but he never said specifically that he agreed with everything that the prosecutor had said, that he agreed with everything that the pre-sentence investigation report said. And the fact that no one was challenging whether these statements were willfully or materially false is not correct. The trial counsel for Mr. Savage did contest the obstruction enhancement, both on the basis of the fact that the pre-sentence investigation report's findings were insufficient and also claiming that Mr. Savage could simply have been confused.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Kervan. Your time has expired. And so we thank you for accepting the appointment. We thank the clinic's distinguished director, for assisting us in the two cases. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 Monday.